Interior designer and showroom owner Peter Dunham was raised in France and educated in England at Stowe. He read modern languages at Exeter College and business administration at the American University in Paris. After graduating, he worked in real estate in New York City. Peter moved to Los Angeles in 1998 and immediately started his interior design company. In 2003, he launched his eponymous fabric and wallpaper collection, now sold through 16 showrooms worldwide. To house a growing collection of handcrafted, made-to-order furniture, textiles, and vintage finds, Peter opened Hollywood at Home in 2007. Located in the Los Angeles Design District, it has become a leading destination for design lovers. In 2020, he established his third product arm, Peter Dunham Home, venturing into stocked indoor-outdoor furniture. At the firm, Peter and his design team split their time between restoring landmarked houses and collaborating with renowned architects on ground-up projects. Current projects include a modernist Marmal Radziner house overlooking the Pacific in Montecito, residences in Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Newport Beach, Montana, and an iconic 1963 Horace Gifford house on Fire Island. The Wall Street Journal described his style as merchant ivory modern and restraint with a kick. His international style embraces color and pattern, mixing bespoke furnishings, vintage finds, and modern luxuries. His design work has been featured in Architectural Digest, Elle Decor, House & Garden, House Beautiful, Coastal Living, The Wall Street Journal, Veranda, Domino, The Hollywood Reporter, Los Angeles Times, and more. Peter has an Elle Decor's A-list and included in Vendome Press's new book, Inspired Design, The 100 Most Important Designers of the Past 100 Years. Peter, we're delighted you could join us. Welcome. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Pamela. Nice to be speaking to you this morning.
Well, you have quite a fascinating story. You're obviously an Angeleno and have been for many years, but are originally from across the pond. Can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how that informed your aesthetic?
Sure, because it very much did. I grew up in Paris with expat parents, somewhat expat parents. My mother was English and my father was half French, half American. So I kind of grew up kind of French, but kind of not. And then I went to school in England when I was about 8. And then I didn't even speak English when I was sent. My mother said, absolutely, he has to go like English people would. And my father, who was more American centered, was horrified about what his friends would think. And 3 weeks later, he came to visit, and I was like the perfect little Englishman. And so that was very much. And then in summer, my parents had this kind of rather eccentric house on the coast in a place called Cadaqués, north of Barcelona, which was kind of just the opposite of English boarding school or Paris apartment. It was free and easy, and we were in the middle of nature, surrounded by national park on the sea, and it kind of had this sense of, I'm going to say, the Mediterranean, with a capital M, in terms of an influence, which persists to this day, and maybe very much why I relate to living in Southern California.
That makes a lot of sense. And I feel like in hearing that, hearing more about your story, that serves to, I guess, connect the dots in your body of work, if you will. When I think about your aesthetic and your beautiful work, your portfolio of various interiors that you've designed, there's certainly an English sensibility in the way that you bring in different patterns and textiles, and it feels very richly layered. But as I was preparing for our call today, I was thinking more about it. And in contrast to some of the other famous English interior designers that one might think of, you also have a more, I guess, a very edited eye. And there seems to be something that feels very fresh and modern about your interiors as well. So you sort of toe the line between what's typically thought of as that English sensibility, or, you know, the way that Europeans tend to design with much a more eclectic slant, but you do it in a way that feels really, really sort of cool.
Well, it's always great to hear what somebody else has to say about one's work, because, you know, kind of
Right.
I never really think about it. It's just instinctive. But I was thinking about this and about kind of the influences of the people I've had on me throughout my life. And one thing that was common to a lot of them was kind of surprisingly an admiration I have for people you wouldn't necessarily think of me being attracted to. But I like their sense of, like, Ward Bennett, for example, who was a fantastic 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s New York designer. That all of them, I sort of have a very strong sense of, I'm going to say, discipline. That the interior layouts of their rooms are very disciplined and very thought out, resolved. And then they take the ones who I really admire, and then the ones who take these kind of what I'm going to call arrogant, daring steps off the cliff, you know, who mix in. And I'm thinking, like, in Texas, for example, the Domeniel House,
Yes.
that was done, you know, so incredibly with this extraordinary mixture where they had this beautiful modernist house, and then they threw in Victoriana, and they threw in different elements that kind of all worked together and was very much them. So I like to create this kind of very sort of almost uptight use of space. And then I like to break the rules. I like to find stuff, and I like to layer in, as you say, and kind of create atmosphere. And it's hard to convey, obviously, when you're looking at somebody's portfolio. But for me, there's a sense in my houses that I'd rather them feel good than look good. I'd rather them have this very strong atmosphere. For me, houses that are very welcoming are much more important than houses that are pretty. And I feel that there's so many times you go into houses that are beautifully done, lots of thoughts gone into them, but they're sterile and they're cold. And that's kind of my mother, who used to disparagingly say about people's houses, it's very decoratory. I think that's what she meant, this kind of sense of almost hotel-like decor in residential
Right, where
settings.
things feel so perfectly done that they seem to lack personality and soul.
Right. And I mean, I remember years and years ago listening to an interview with Michael Smith, and he said, you know, we really, in the houses we do, write the portrait of the occupants. So you have to, like, glean from them what are their interests, what are their things that are just so not them. So you create a house around them that resembles them, that in fact heightens them, you know, that kind of makes them seem more intelligent, more cultured, more beautiful, thinner, fatter, whatever they want to be. But that's kind of the role we do. And I agree with him. As designers, we're sort of portraitists of the people who
That's such a
hire
brilliant
us.
way to put it. That's very, very true.
Yeah. And I don't take credit for it. That's ex Michael who does a
I
clear
well,
interview, I
yes, I
have to
know. I
say.
actually just spoke with him and we have an episode airing soon, but he is obviously so incredibly talented and has such a p fantastic perspective on design and the business of design, of course. So, Peter, have you always known? It sounds like you've always been drawn to aesthetics, or you've always had an eye for things, let's say, but did you always know that you were destined to be a designer as your profession?
Yes and no is the answer to that. And I'd say yes, because when I was very young, my first summer job, found by my best friend at school's mother, she found us both a summer job working for some decorators, these Zazu decorators on Sloane Street called Zarak. And that was when I was 15 going on 16. And we were, like, you know, clearing up the stock room and, like, doing whatever errands. But I just loved it. Loved it, loved it. And then I worked for them 2 summers. And then I went to university in Paris, and they wanted you to do kind of internships. So I got an internship with another friend of mine's father called David Hicks, who is to this day an enormous influence. and I worked in his Paris office. So I had these sort of experiences. And then I was always very interested in transforming space. It was always something that fascinated me. Cut to David, another friend of mine from his uncle was somebody called Teddy Millington Drake, who was kind of a great tastemaker, who was the partner of John Stephanides. And John then would say, "Oh no, my dear boy, this is a terrible way to make a living." And David said the same thing. And so I was kind of shied off of it. And so my father said, "Well, you really want to go back to, you really want to go and live in New York. Why don't you go into the real estate business?" I thought, "Wow, what's that?" I didn't even think about it. I mean, I'd never met a realtor or a developer. It just wasn't something that I'd met in my life. And so I went to New York and found a job working for Douglas Elliman at a time of when it was a 85 person brokerage company. And I was the youngest by about 40 years. But every year they wanted to take one young man to create some diversity. And so then I worked in real estate for 15 years, very much with an interest of selling things to people that they could transform, that had potential. That's kind of what excited me. And a lot of my clientele came to me for that. And then I started doing flip houses, kind of buying apartments, fixing them up, turning them over. And I ended up doing one in the village by the skin of its teeth that was kind of a four-story crack house that I ended up selling to James Murdoch, of all people. And it had been a complete kind of a wreck of a building. And it taught me a huge amount because you could see the sky when you walked in the front door when I bought it. And when I finished it, Catherine, his then girlfriend, walked in and said, "Oh, finally a house with its original detail." And little did she know, I hope she's not listening now, but I basically dove for the best part of 2 years, getting old windows and fireplaces and paneling and everything to reconstruct this building the way I thought it should be. The way an 1820s kind of Greek revival house would have been. So I was really thrilled when those are the first words of the first buyer who walked into the house when I finished it. And that financed my move to Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, this is super long-winded. I'm
No, it's
sorry if
fantastic.
everybody's falling asleep. But when I moved to Los Angeles for love, I met somebody here and I went back and forth. And I thought, God, this is kind of great. And if I don't leave New York now, aged 36, I think, I'm never leaving New York. So I should just take a step off the cliff and try it. And then when I got here, I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do here? I don't really know that many people. I don't want to go back into the real estate business and learn a whole new geography. And I didn't really enjoy it that much anyway. So what am I going to do? Well, I guess I'll continue flipping houses. So I did a couple of flip houses and then one got published. And then a friend said, "Well, would you help my friend who's just bought a house?" And it was a time of a building boom in the late 90s when honestly, a dog, if they could get a resale license, could get jobs decorating. I mean, anyone could. There was just so much work. So I started by these little projects that were like $25,000, $40,000, and building it up. What I realized when I'd finished my very first room for a young executive at a studio, I installed the whole room, and suddenly I had this revelation that, oh, this is what creative satisfaction is really about. And for the 15 years that I'd been working in real estate in New York, I'd been satisfied with a lot of the clever moves I'd done, but I'd never had that feeling, that creative satisfaction. And I think for all of us who are in the creative field, it's a huge part of what gets us out of bed in the morning, that gets us through the vicissitudes of these projects. As Victoria Hagen once said, decorating is just about staying one step ahead of Murphy's Law. But in spite of that, we kind of get this extraordinary sense of achievement at the end when it's done, or when we've photographed it, when we've taken that extra step of styling it and putting the flowers we want and everything. It's hugely satisfying. And I think that's a very important part. So in a long-winded way, I sort of always wanted to. I followed people's advice and I used the experience of being in a very tough-nosed business in New York where you had to learn how to read financial statements, negotiate with people, make them super comfortable about getting them not just to a purchase, but through a co-op board, like a club. And all these things really, and then my experience actually building and completely restoring buildings were all experiences that prepared me for the design world, where you have to connect with people who are business people and they want to know that you can deal with a budget and you know how to read a budget and stay on budget and and how to talk to people, is and how to read them. So all those things I learned from the 15 years, instead of going to Parsons, I got that, from
Exactly.
selling
Well,
real
and those are
estate.
things that you don't learn in design school, all of those intangible business skills and interpersonal skills, because as you sort of alluded to, so much of this job is understanding how to not only manage the day-to-day tasks of a project, but understanding how to inspire confidence in very demanding clients oftentimes, and to really be able to show that you're capable and confident in not only executing a vision, but in bringing the project to life within budget and on the timeline and all of those things.
Right. And I think you've got to give people a huge sense of you're taking care of their needs. So I try and take a picture away, like, and I said it yesterday to somebody who disagreed with me about tiling for a shower. And I said, look, she said, I know you're not going to like this. And I said, honestly, I'm not the one who's living with it. So, you should really live with what you want. And I think that once you do that, and you really kind of are very responsive to servicing people's needs, I think they really appreciate that. And part of why I love, and we get called to do a lot of ground up or big renovation jobs, is that why I love doing that is it gives you 6 months a year to really get to trust each other. And to understand just by like, do you like the right hand side of the vanity in the bathroom, or do you like the left? Do you like a plug-in toothbrush, or do you like whatever? So it just by taking care of the little bits and pieces, they understand that you have their best interests at heart and you're
What do you think
focusing
is
on
most
that.
important?
And I
Sure.
think that's very
What do you think is
important.
most important in terms of achieving that level of trust?
Well, I think, like I just said, kind of listening to it, but also stimulating the conversation about things that they'd never thought about. So you keep on peppering things like, well, do you like a plug in your bedside table? Or do you need just things that are everyday things that are luxury things that people may not have been exposed to before, have thought about? And, you kind of suggest things as you go along, and they kind of start getting excited because you're thinking about the way they actually want to live, but hadn't really kind of gotten in
Right.
touch
And
with
then,
it
of course, you're adding
themselves.
value by providing that perspective that they wouldn't have come up with on their own.
Right, I think so. I'm by nature, I was unfortunate for many people around me, born under the sign of Leo. So I like to get at least 120 or 130% out of everything I do. So, and it's very challenging. It was very challenging for my poor parents. But it just the way I came out. And I think, when you're talking about giving value added, we are a very expensive luxury. And I think it's incumbent on us to give people, to make their houses more valuable, to make their lifestyle, to make their comfort and their quality of life way greater than it was before they hired you. So that's kind of my
Absolutely.
goals, I
Well,
guess.
Peter, can you tell us a little bit about your design process? Where do you like to begin when you're starting on a new project?
Well, very much on the floor plan. And we obviously, we collaborate a lot with the architects throughout the process. Hopefully, we get hired early enough in the process that we can be making tweaks to the floor plan from the get-go. Or often the architects will present to us the floor plan first and, like, okay, what do you think? And I said, well, I heard her say this. Well, because I've done two other houses for this client, I know that this resembles what they had before and felt comfortable with. So the floor plan to me is like the absolute roadmap for everything we do. And then when it comes to the furniture layout and the use of space, it's very much worked out on floor plan. So which are the areas? So for me, it's very important to create strong, resolved destinations. I hate the, God, I shouldn't say I hate. I don't care so much that for kind of furniture layout like they have in staged houses often, where they just kind of float the furniture in the middle because they don't know quite what else to do with it, because the house was already done. I like to resolve a lot of that before so that I have the wall spaces I want. So I have a bed wall with big enough bedside tables either side of them. I like to resolve a lot of this before so the decorating just flows in super easily. But I'm very adamant, I guess, about creating places to attract you in a house. So, like, the biggest challenge is always the living room or the dining room. People always report not using them very much. So I'll always try and push the envelope, say, well, why don't we really make your living room more a family room? Because we can do this to it, and then it'll pull you in there. Or the dining room, why don't we make it a dining room kind of library that the kids can use to do their tutorials in or their homework? Just anything to, I'm very strong at figuring, I'm sorry, I don't mean strong, I'm very focused on trying to figure out how to best use the space and not just make it look good when people walk in the door once a year for those people's holiday party. I want there to be a reveal as you walk through the house. Oh, this is kind of a cool little area. This is kind of smart here. So it's kind of the furniture layout is extremely important to me. And we obviously give clients a couple of options. And then we try and convince them, like, why this is not every day's normal thing of putting two sofas flanking the fireplace in the living room, but this is better. Maybe we don't have to focus exactly on the fireplace. We can spread two areas further apart and make the room more interesting or bigger or more unusual. So it's very much the floor plan is really my biggest tool. It's weird enough. I can only work in quarter inch scales. After all these years, the minute somebody comes up with a 3/16 or a half inch scale, it completely puts me off because I can just draw rough hand a bedside table in perfect scale
That's amazing.
on a quarter inch
That's amazing.
plan.
Have you found that since the onset of the pandemic, your clients' needs have changed at all, or are they asking to use some of the spaces that you referenced in a different way than they may have previously?
I would say yes and yes. It's sort of all sorts of calls came in throughout the call from existing clients. Obviously, a lot of people were stuck at home. Even if it was their second or third home, they were like often stuck for way longer than they'd ever been anywhere before. And so I had some clients who said to me, I love the room you did. It was great. But after using it so much, it's not exactly what I want. I had other clients who called me saying, oh my God, we're frantic. We've never spent the summer, spring, and summer here before. We're always in Aspen. We need teak furniture. And this was like 2.5 weeks into the pandemic. My husband doesn't have anywhere comfortable to sit outside. We never gave it a second thought. So a lot of people didn't. And I happen to have a teak collection that's in stock. And I was like, okay, well, I'll go and meet the delivery guys myself, and I'll come and deliver it myself because I didn't want any of my colleagues to be the front people at that stage of the pandemic, but I was okay me going to do it. So a lot of people called with a lot of different things, and but I would say those are the most things. And then people realized from being in their houses that they'd become shabbier than they kind of had noticed after 10, 15 years. Things needed recovering. The dogs had chewed the cushions, the you name it. I mean, it wasn't the most exciting period in my design career, but I was glad to get calls
Well,
and
of
to feel
course.
useful of some type. Yeah.
What percentage of your time do you focus on your design firm and your clients versus Hollywood at home and your textile collection and furniture and everything else, all those various facets of your business? Does it depend on the day?
Yes, it depends. Honestly, the thing that probably takes the front, always the priority for me, are clients who obviously who need attention now. We're heading towards an installation. There's kind of pressure. So I would say, depending on what our workload is and how close we are, where I'm needed, then that'll take priority. But I would say, I would think that it's probably 60 to 75% interior design, and it's probably, and it doesn't, it's not going to add up to 100, but I'm
Well, you're a
120%
Leo,
sure,
you
guy.
said.
Exactly. So I'm going to say there's probably 20%, 20 to 25% of my time spent on textiles, and 20 to 25% of my time is spent at Hollywood at Home and developing furniture. So that's kind of how it, and also buying vintage, and it's kind of a multi, as you know from doing all the things you do, it's multifaceted. Sometimes it's promotional, sometimes it's going to visit showrooms to stir up action, sometimes it's going to the printers to do strike offs at 7 a.m. Sometimes it's going across the country to shop for vintage or to Europe. So, but it all kind of bundles together. And when you have your own business, you kind of don't really work an 8 to 10 hour day.
That is very true. As a creative,
It's
yeah,
often
that's
more.
every day, truly. As a creative entrepreneur, do you feel it's important to have more than one revenue stream in one's business as you've created for yourself?
Padma, I should ask you that question because you have like unbelievable number of partnerships, deals you've done, things. So I'm
Oh,
like I
wow,
want to be
please.
you. But I would say, and I think you probably agree with me, I think it's vital to have more than one source, not just because there are potential huge dips in demand for our services, but because within a stable environment, let's say, there may be a time when the projects didn't come to you in the last 3 months that were interesting or that came. So you may have 3 months, 6 months where you don't get any new projects. So that translates into a year or two later, you've got a gap in your schedule. So I'm very much the type, for example, who will not just say, I'm going to take minimum $1 million budget jobs. I'm very much about keeping the office busy. And if I can take a smaller project that's maybe $150,000, $200,000 project, like I can put one of the more junior designers in charge of it so they can grow. And it also keeps things flowing. If you have like five or six of those and some of the big ones aren't coming up right now, you've still got the income. So just within the design, I'm very much about varying the type of clients
Right, I
we
would
take
completely
on.
agree with that.
And some of the smaller ones are kind of more fun. Their expectations are sort of lower. They'll take more risks. They'll let you do more fun, crazy things. And they're, in a way, more fans of yours, if that makes a sense, if that makes sense. And then And then in terms of the rest, it was all serendipity with me. I started textiles because I love textiles and I'd always collected them. And David Hicks, who was such an influence, and John Stefanidis, who was such an influence, also had textiles, and they also had furniture lines, and they also had stores. And I never thought about it, but slowly I started with a textile line. And then I opened a store because in my own market in LA, I felt the need to have our own kind of brick and mortar presence, not to be in a multi-line showroom where we could really reveal what we're about and what the mix we like to do and to, do walls of display and all this stuff. And then I started peppering it with furniture, vintage stuff that I'd hoarded. Hoarding is a big part of my life too. And all this vintage that I'd always been collecting for pro eventual projects, I kind of started putting it in to decorate this new little shop I created. And then people started buying that. And then we was like, okay, well, let's just reproduce that, or stuff that I would make for clients over and over again. We then started putting into the shop, and before I knew it, we kind of had a furniture business and a vintage business and a textile business. And so that it's kind of all serendipity. But what was great about that, the times when, like during the Great Recession of 2008 to 12, whatever, people would still buy textiles. Our textiles sales were strong, even if our project and our income from doing interior design projects, reduced greatly. People were still buying textiles, and there are a couple of years in which the shop and the textiles really paid everything. So it's, I think, a very good way to do it. I look at my personal trainer, he's an actor, so there's no
Right.
acting right now. And so luckily he has personal training. And during the COVID, guess what? All his clients went from doing it twice a week to every day online. And he didn't have to travel and he didn't have to pay a gym mem fees to go to. So he had the second income that made up for all his lost income as an actor. So I think generally it's a very good philosophy for
Yes.
everyone. If you're working in a law firm, like it's really great if you have like, I don't know, like a knitting business on the
Well,
side, if that's what your passion
that's
is.
such a huge component of it. I think, you really touched on the fact that it's important because there are external factors that will happen that we inevitably have no control over when there are dips in the economy and things like this pandemic where we can't necessarily foresee those things coming and we have to be prepared, and it helps to have a different stream of revenue. But on the other hand, I think it's also important to diversify from a creative standpoint. I know for me, at least, these different facets of my business feed my creativity in different ways. And as much as I love working with my clients, it's also really nice to be able to do something that doesn't have to factor in an external influence in terms of, what the final product or the aesthetic is. And I suspect that you feel the same way in terms of not only your textile and furniture lines, but with Hollywood at Home, the showroom, being able to curate that. And it, at the end of the day, is truly an embodiment of your taste.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's great when you can do your own design for yourself. It's a bit like decorating your own house. It's fun. You can keep on changing it. You can keep on coming up with new solutions. And I think, if you're passionate about design, like we both are, when you're designing lighting, for example, if you happen to have a lighting collection, then that takes you out of, like, where the hell are those 4 yards from Clarence House that didn't arrive and it's got lost? And you go into a different sphere. You go into your own little bubble of creating that. And I think it's really kind of a good
I would
balance
agree. There are certain,
to the
yes,
day to day.
it's fulfilling in a different way, and client projects, as wonderfully fulfilling as they are, they aren't always the easiest. And it takes a lot longer to get to the finish line on that than it does to sell somebody some yardage or of some found objects.
I agree. I agree in creating those fabrics or finding those objects and converting them. A lot of what we do is what one of my coworkers calls doing the Peter touch to them. So, I'll buy something in some flea market or some auction and with in mind, like, oh no, that dining table is going to make the great. We can't sell dining tables, but coffee tables sell really well. So I'm going to convert it into a coffee table. So that's
That's so
kind of
interesting. How long have
satisfying.
you had the showroom now?
I wish I remembered, but I'm going to think the very first one we opened was 15 years ago, I
Wow.
think, something like that. I was looking for sort of a little place that could be an office. And there was a little complex kind of in West Hollywood where there was Nathan Turner, there was Claremont Fabrics, there was Lucas Design downstairs, and there was a space above. So I got together with everybody and I said, look, there's this really horrible little parking courtyard that we all park in. Let's move all the cars out. Let's plant a big tree. Let's put some gravel. Let's do a bit of landscaping and let's call it Almont Yard and get it people branded as a go-to destination, which actually worked really well. And, Joe Lucas turned his business downstairs into Harbinger. And, Nathan's business was attracting a certain type of people and Claremont others. And so we kind of fed each other. It was kind of really interesting and fun. And we were all much younger businesses, and so being together as a little collective really worked very well. And the whole thing had a very California courtyard vibe, which was
I
really
remember it, but I
charming.
never realized that it was
Um,
your
and then
brainchild. That's fascinating.
I think it kind of was, yeah. I mean, again, it's that thing of I love transforming space. It's kind of what always got me up. I think I remember doing sketching little floor plans during math class in high school. The transformation of space is always something that I enjoy tremendously. I mean, much as we love a house where you can just back up the truck, it's already done, and maybe all you had to do is paint, and you can just like shovel it in. It's great from the point of view of business. It's like easy. You can drop in and out in a 4 to 6 month lead time. And you're out, but it's kind of the other that really excites me more, the kind of transforming of an old dog, into something great, or to be working on a completely ground up house and really think about and really, really like look at the space and figure out what's the best way to go. That I find really
Right. Well,
satisfying.
what else inspires you besides the prospect of creating something out of nothing? It sounds like you love a project, but where do you turn for inspiration?
I would say travel's very important. It's much as one hasn't been able to
Right.
do that this year very much. Travel's very important. I was in Egypt, for example, in February, and I'd been 25 years before, but this time I kind of had a different experience there that was much more without guides, and I went with my partner and we went to see like really interesting things and really off. I love finding kind of off the beaten track places that are kind of gems and what they do and the colors and how the architecture's handled. And I find that's very inspiring. Wherever I go is often kind of semi-work. If the IRS is listening, I can really almost definitely justify deducting my trips because everywhere I go, I get something. I go to India, I'm going to be looking for something to buy. I'm going to look for something that I can take their technique and create for the store. Or the only type of real vacation for me, I mean, there are two types, is to go to a ski resort where nothing inspires me. I've yet to go to a ski resort that actually inspired me. So all I do is think about the next turn down the hill with sheer terror, or really kind of an island resort that doesn't have much going for it except beautiful sea, where there's not much to do that way either. But otherwise, I tend to like travel and I like the stimulation. And even if I go up to San Francisco, I'm always heightened looking. You know, I'm always looking at little lobbies of buildings, and I like the way they did the little mosaic tile floors in the entrance, and I'm taking pictures and thinking I can put that in a bathroom and stuff like that. Then I would say art is really important. I go and try and see a lot of museums because I get a lot of inspiration of color combinations, for example, what works, what doesn't, and just subliminally seeing that kind of creation. And I think artists make you look at things in a fresh way when they're successful. And so that's a big part of it. Galleries, and museums, definitely. And I'll try and go to every house that's open to the public somewhere I go. It's something I learned from David Hicks. He would make a list of everywhere he was going, and like, I'm going to Lisbon, and you know, there are these 10 things I want to see. It makes it for an exhausting travel partner
Right.
for people who go with me, but that's kind of, I feel regenerated. I come back like, okay, I've got my batteries are back up and going. And then I would say books are very important. I've always liked looking at books and see what kind of more historic designers have done, to see how they made solutions. So I think that that's kind of important. And then I have a lot of very creative friends, to be honest, who I think are much more creative than I am, like Mattia Bonetti, who's one of my closest friends, or the landscaper Madison Cox, or you know, Ashley Hicks and Allegra Hicks. And I mean, I have a whole sort of a little posse of friends who are tremendously creative and live in cool places that have a lot of thought put into them. So that's a big source of inspiration. And then there are people who I was just exposed to, like David Hicks, like Teddy Minnington Drake and John Stefanidis, who were fantastic homemakers. I mean, they were just beautiful houses. And then some personal ones, you know, who I grew up with. There was a friend of my parents in our village in Spain called Sue Guinness, who's just had the flair for it. To this day, you know, her houses always took my breath away, or they always excited me. My heart beat a little quicker seeing how she did it and how she made a house interesting and welcoming and quirky. And the people like the recently deceased antique dealer Christopher Gibbs, who had a wonderful house in Tangiers at the end of his life. But he'd always had a fantastic shop in very eclectic off Bond Street when I was in high school. And I would always stop and I would, you know, like go there and there'd be like one of the Rolling Stones hanging around smoking hash. And there would be like designer people from New York. And there was just an amazing mixture of things that inspired me and that very much inspired my kind of eclectic mix. So that all these
Sure.
things
Well, it
inspire
sounds,
me.
I mean, fantastic. Obviously, I think all of those things are not only inspiring in the way that one would obviously assume, but there's something about whether it's travel or transporting oneself through a book or a work of art or being in a gallery, just taking your eye and traveling, whether it's by plane or literally just walking down the street and popping into the gallery to inform one's eye and to just have that change of scenery can be so energizing and recharging.
Right. I think in one sentence, you've said what it
But
took
it
me
sounds so
10
much
minutes to
better coming
babble.
out of your mouth with
Yes.
your beautiful accent and your
No, it doesn't. But, you know, I think if anything that takes you out of your daily commute to work where you literally don't look anymore, I think is makes your way. I think as a designer, it's really important. You have to be, in my opinion, somebody who's constantly got the roving eye. Or what did Diana Vreeland say? Like
That's
the eye
right.
must travel. The eye's got to constantly be looking and be curious.
That's so true. Well, what are you currently working on that you're most excited about, Peter?
Well, we just started working on a new ground-up house here in Los Angeles on this kind of wonderful, quirky piece of land that's kind of on a cliff and a little interesting topography that's going to be beautiful. I'm working with that with the architects Titchener Thorpe, who've done like designs that just blew me away from the get-go. And these are clients who I've done a couple of houses for before. We're starting to work on a house in Montecito and then another one near Santa Ynez that I think is going to be fun because it's not such a pretty house. And even if the client isn't listening in, the client repeatedly said to me, if I was starting from scratch, this would not be the house that I would build. And I agree with her. But you know, that'll be interesting making it. Trying to make something beautiful. I mean, what did they say? Making a silk
Right.
purse out of a sow's ear. And then from the design point of view, you know, I'm always looking for my, I'm going to call them my side gigs. You know, we're developing new teak stuff for next year to come out because that's been kind of been successful and been fun to do stuff that wasn't really available for the public at a kind of decent price. Teak stuff is either too small because a lot of people have smaller spaces, but in LA we have bigger spaces. And I love as soon as new materials come, like this fantastic kind of you know, extruded something fake rush. I was so excited and we started doing a lot of rush stuff because I love the texture and that's very much kind of the narrative of Hollywood at home. And you know, and then we're moving on to the next phase of textiles. So then that's, to be honest, almost the
Really?
hardest one. Yes, because you kind of face with a blank slate at the beginning of every fall. We're like, okay, what are we going to do? And then, okay, what does our collection need? So, for example, our outdoor, you know, indoor outdoor woven sombrella stuff. You know, we've been doing it for about 3 or 4 years. We've been doing about for about 4 years ever since sombrella started coming up with really great color yarns. They went from aqua yellow, bright pink, terrible green to like beautiful indigos and soft reds and beautiful greens. That really got me excited, and I said, okay, let's do a woven collection. And so we sit there and we think, okay, well, this is what we already have. What do we need? What does Peter Dunham and his team as designers need in their projects? So we think about that. And then we think about like, we need a couple of things that are going to excite the Instagram, the editorial. So you have pieces that you might not sell that much of, but they kind of have more of a bling factor. And so you kind of balance all those out, but you're starting with a completely blank slate. And with prints, it's the same. You know, you're sitting down and figuring out what do we need? What are things that maybe are missing? What are designs that I like? What I'll go rummaging through my boxes of vintage things from 20 years ago or that I bought last year and will convert, generally convert something, you know, change the scale, clean up the pattern. Just take an element of it. It may be, you know, something that I started piling up things, you know, that were like bookend patterns or something. But that's kind of starting off with a much blanker slate than a house and a client with specific type of needs, young children, or they want it more formal or thing. I mean, you've got
Sure.
more constraints. The other one, it's like, okay, Peter, just like, make your best shot at like doing what you do that hopefully people are going to like and enough people are going to like that you can sustain a business
Well,
from.
I can see why that would be daunting, but clearly you've figured out your knack for it because you've expanded your line tremendously over the years, and it's so beloved.
You know, it's been fun, and I think I mumbled it before in this conversation. You know, it's really important in life to do something you love. Even if you left school and you get a great job working on Wall Street, textiles, interestingly enough, the textiles are really fun because it's kind of a way that you connect with the greatest number of people. civilization almost, where people are using your textiles in completely different ways. But it is super frigging satisfying when you look at a magazine or you see people's work on Instagram and they've used your fabric. You know,
Well, I
it's
can
kind of
imagine,
like
yeah.
it still, after all this time, kind of surprises me and blows me away. I often think of it as like my little treasure that I use for my projects as much as I can. But no, there are people who like it and there are people who kind of narrative is through
Right.
my
How
textiles.
many fabrics did you launch with? Do you remember how many patterns there were?
There were
And was
five
fig leaf one
patterns
of them?
and there were about three or four colors each.
Yeah,
It
I mean,
definitely
it's
was.
iconic at this point. It's such a great, the scale on it is so great.
It's, just starting was kind of a fun little story because Mary McAvoy, who was kind of a
Sure.
legendary editor at the time, who had created Elle Decor from scratch and then moved on after a while to be the editor-in-chief of House Beautiful, and created kind of the amazing year or year and a half of issues of House Beautiful, said, call me up one day and said, I'm coming to town, I want to have lunch. I said, okay, now Peter, we're doing this show house, decorated show house here, and we've never done one before, and you've got to be in it. And I was like, man, I didn't even have an assistant. I didn't have any money. I'd heard about like, doing these show houses is so expensive. And I was such a small designer. I didn't have what I call my frequent flyer miles for my upholsterer and my curtain maker and everybody else. So I was like, Marion, no. She said, you have to do something. I'm telling you, I'm not taking no for an answer. So God bless her. I did do it. And I thought, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I thought, well, I'm going to do the kitchen because that I know that there's a sponsor for the kitchen and it'll be a lot of work and pain in the ass, but I can do it. Cut to it was a huge success. And 18 months later, they decided to do it again. And the first time, here I was, this complete unknown little squirt between Barbara Barrie, Waldo, and Suzanne Reinstein. And people were like, who's this doing the kitchen? Because everyone kind of looks at the kitchen. And then the next time I said, okay, I'm going to take a bedroom because I kind of like doing these textiles for clients for my own projects. So I thought I'm going to have fun and I'm going to do a kind of Indian inspired bedroom and I'm going to do a fig leaf bathroom, which I would never do in a project, jam so much pattern together that almost discordant, but I figured in the photographs it'll never show. So I did the fabrics, and after we installed it, designers started walking through. And after about the fourth one came through, like, where can I buy your textiles? I thought, light finding went off in my brain. And I thought, okay, I better come up with a textile line. Why not? And so between November, when the show house was, and March, when the issue of House Beautiful was coming out that was going to celebrate the show house, I had all those months to come up with the artwork, come up with the screens, stop doing strike offs. I knew nothing. I literally knew nothing. But by luck, I met this person who could actually help me with it, who was an expert at it. And so we took all these Indian block prints that I'd been making, and then we started printing them here in Los Angeles, screen printing them by hand. And so just as the magazine came out, I decided, okay, I'm going to go to New York and go see my friends and see if I can sell some of this stuff. So the first person I stopped into was Albert Hadley because I had a friend who worked there. And Albert Hadley was always somebody I've always had an enormous design crush on. And he sat there at his little office at his renewed office, just as Albert Hadley Inc. after he left Parrish Hadley, and it was on 64th Street, and it was very neat. And we sat around the table, and they're very kind. And he looked at my fabrics, and he landed on the fig leaf and said, "This is perfect. We're going to use this at that project." He was my
That's
first
incredible.
sale, my
What a
absolute
story.
first sale, and he picked up the phone, and said, "Where are you going to?" So he asked me, where are you going to sell these? And I said, well, I don't really have a showroom yet. They're just coming out. You're the first person I'm showing them to. And he picked up the phone and called his friend John Roselli and said, I'm sending you a kid over with some with some fun fabrics to look at. So John said, "Well, come on over now." And he took me then with my five designs, my 15 SKUs, and we've been there ever since. You know, it's kind of to me a very heartwarming story of old timers helping a new timer. And you know, and there were people who I so admired, John for his antique story and Albert for everything he did. So it was kind of it was very
Of
encouraging
course. Well, it
start.
sounds a little bit like a design fairy tale to sell your first bit of fabric to Albert Hadley of all people and to get his stamp of approval, and then to have John Roselli be your first stockist is incredible.
Yeah, no, it
That's
was
amazing.
great.
Well,
I'm
as we
very, very
begin to wrap
grateful.
up, I'll ask you a couple more questions. If you could go back in time, is there a piece of advice that you would give your younger self, Peter?
Take more risk. You know, if I don't know, actually, something like let it flow or something. Because the path I took, I sometimes thought, like, why didn't I start this sooner? Maybe I'd be Peter Marino by now, as if, you know. But it's more. And then I come down and think, well, you know, all the experiences I learned in New York in those 15 years, like they get me through every single project. So they were really kind of invaluable lessons. And actually, they let me travel a huge amount. I traveled 3 or 4 months a year because I didn't have any fixed overhead or fixed management responsibilities. So I guess it's kind of what would I go back and tell myself? I mean, if I was really sensible, I'd say start saving more money earlier in your life. But that's way too boring and way too boring a story. But you know, I think part of the thing I kind of maybe see myself that I regret not doing is having connected with more people that I admired and reached out, certainly as a designer. I'm always thinking, for example, you know, I really admire Rose Tarlow. Why in all these years haven't I just picked up a pen, written her little note saying, you know, I really have a crush on you? I mean, not in those terms. Can I come and see you? You know, and there are many times when I lost that opportunity. So, kind of, I would say maybe grab every opportunity as it comes to you. I can be a little cautious in my approach, but maybe just like be more
That's a great
daring.
reminder.
And yeah, and definitely, if I were giving my advice to anyone, it goes back to, you know, really think about doing something you love that gets you excited, that gets you out of bed every day. I know it's risky, sometimes it's not realistic, but it's, you know, it's really important. And I think at the end of the day, you always end up doing that
That's
thing
true.
anyway.
I couldn't agree with that more. Well, I'll ask you one last question, Peter, as we wrap up. What is currently giving you hope in the world of design or otherwise?
Well, I mean, to be honest, we're one of the few businesses, apart from tech businesses, that have done incredibly well during this corona period. You know, people are focused on their houses, so they want to redo, renew. They want to buy second, third, fourth houses to get away from, you know, people suddenly bought the day it opened, they bought every house in Ojai and they bought every house that was available in Santa Barbara. And I know every house in the Hamptons sold. So people are definitely, so it's in our business, it's an incredibly optimistic time. I'm hoping that next year will be as good because who knows what's around the corner. But I would say there's kind of, I would say kind of a sense of maybe great kindness, compassion. I mean, I had one client on a house we're doing in Napa that I'm very excited about that I forgot to mention. But you know, she said, look, you know, we had to close down for COVID, but we know the people on the job might not all be getting unemployment insurance, whatever. So we want to make sure they're getting paid. I mean, like, who the hell would have thought about doing that before? You know, there are people who the same client wanted to do a silent day yesterday, you know, in memory of Black Lives Matter. and shut down the whole project, but they also wanted to make sure that everyone was getting paid. So my wallpaper hanger, who's up there all week, like had a day, kind of a wasted day, but they reached out and said, we want to make sure that we've covered that. So there's, I think, this sense of kind of community and the sense of compassion, which has kind of grown out of all this. And I think an acceptance of, like, shit happens. So, it's not exactly the right red, or it's not quite exactly whatever. The guy got it slightly wrong, whatever, but it's just fine. Let's go with it. There are more important things
Right. I
going
think
on
it's
in
lent
life.
us all a little bit of perspective.
Yeah, definitely. And very much with the clients, we try and do everything perfectly and push, 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 because, but a lot of the clients have been much kinder. They've all paid their bills. My accounts receivables are way down compared to a year ago, where people were much slower paying. So that's kind of given me hope that with COVID, with the Black Lives Movement, that there's kind of this renewed sense of kind of community, which I don't think was around last year or
Right.
the year
I feel that
before.
too, Peter. I think that's certainly been a silver lining in this time. Fantastic. Well, you've been absolutely
Yeah,
fabulous. Thank you
definitely.
so much for sharing more about your story. It's been so fun to learn more about how you got started in the business and hearing about all of the amazing things that you're doing. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, I am so flattered because I feel that I've been on like the daily for the New York Times podcast, but of design. I mean, I think there are few people who have been able to do what you've done in terms of communication and getting messages out and, doing these interviews. So I'm incredibly flattered to be part of
That's
your
very
roster.
kind.
So thank you is more like
Absolutely,
it.
anytime. But I hope to see you soon, Peter. Hopefully, when all this is. All
Likewise,
right, take good care.
likewise. Okay,
Bye-bye.
take care. Bye.
That was interior designer, textile designer, and showroom owner Peter Dunham. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to visit us online at palomacontreras.com under the podcast tab, where you can find more episodes featuring inspiring conversations with creatives. You can listen directly on our website or subscribe via Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the Style Files, please consider spreading the word and leaving us a positive rating or review. It will only take a few minutes of your time and will make a big difference for us. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.